Thank you all for being here, especially on a rainy day. We appreciate it. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. It's my pleasure to welcome all of you here this morning. I encourage folks to move forward and leave room in the back for late arrivals. We're here today, of course, for our conference, the Federalist Society's conference, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Antitrust Paradox, published by Judge Robert Bork, a highly acclaimed and even revolutionary book on antitrust, published in 1978, 40 years ago. Not only has it revolutionized thinking in antitrust policy, it's influenced the Supreme Court and every other court in the United States, and indeed has had effects throughout the world. And the influence of Judge Bork, of course, extends far beyond antitrust to judicial philosophy, originalism, American culture, and so much more. Selfishly and institutionally, I would acknowledge his significant role in the founding of the Federalist Society and its maintenance for decades afterwards. So we're indebted to him for that as well. And although we focus today on antitrust, I do want to take the liberty of expressing my personal and professional respect and even awe for Judge Bork. And also, we're very pleased to have with us today his son, Bob Bork, and his grandson, Robert Bork, in attendance. So thank you both for attending. And I'm finally pleased to announce that we're working with the family to have the Antitrust Paradox republished in the near future, so keep your eyes open for that. It's no longer in print, sadly. I have a tattered copy on my bookshelf in the office that I wouldn't even risk bringing here today to wave to you. But turning now to our program, we're honored to have the Honorable Macon Delrahim, Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, with us today to deliver our opening address. Born in Iran in 1969, Mr. Delrahim immigrated to the United States with his family and went on to earn a Bachelor of Science in Kinesiology from the University of California, Los Angeles. I think that's the study of body movement, so maybe you were going to be a physical therapist. He then earned a JD from GW Law School and a Master of Science from Johns Hopkins University. He served as Chief of Staff in the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee under President George W. Bush. He served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the same antitrust division he now heads, where he oversaw the appellate, foreign commerce, and legal policy sections. He then practiced antitrust and intellectual property law as a partner at a national firm in Los Angeles, and taught as an adjunct professor at Pepperdine's Law School. After the election of President Trump in 2016, he served as deputy assistant and deputy counsel to the president. The following year, President Trump nominated him as assistant attorney general for the antitrust division at the Department of Justice, where he's been serving in that position since September of 2017. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Macon Delrahim.
Thank you so much, Dean, and thanks for the Federalist Society for organizing a great event to honor the 40th anniversary of a great book written by a great man. It's an honor to be with you and to be with both Mr. Borks here and also with the true legal luminaries that will be here on some of the panels. I wish I could stay for the whole day because I would love to learn, but I'm looking forward to reading the transcript and learning from a lot of the folks, including some of my legal heroes, Judge Ginsburg and Judge Silberman, who will be here today. Both had the great pleasure to serve alongside Judge Bork on the D.C. Circuit. Though not everyone here had a close relationship with Judge Bork, what all of us share in common is that for decades, we have lived, worked, and served in Judge Bork's shadows. I have a side note, outside of antitrust, I had the great pleasure and honor when I was working on the Senate Judiciary Committee to work on the front lines on some of the judicial confirmations, which sadly, I think, when started going downhill with the fate of Judge Bork's nomination to the Supreme Court, but has continued to race its way to places that are not great for the country, I think. And I remember just the respects that the folks in the Senate had for Judge Bork after he had already left and he was in private practice. One night after the 2002 elections, when the Republicans had just won the Senate back, and there was a backlog of a number of judicial nominees, two of whom I think were for the D.C. Circuit, Miguel Estrada and John Roberts. And even though the cloture rules, which required 60 votes to end debate and take a vote, were still in effect, it was unprecedented to use that process up to that point to block the confirmation of a judicial nominee for the courts of appeals, or frankly for any other position at that point. So we began seeing that with President Bush's nominees. And when we won, I said, there's just something wrong when Senator Reid took the floor and said, there's no amount of time imaginable in the universe, and I think that's a direct quote, for me to debate the nomination of Miguel Estrada. So even though he had bipartisan support, he didn't have the votes for the 60 votes. So I said, you know, maybe there's a constitutional argument here. And a couple of friends who were in my office in the Senate, we began discussing. And I said, you know, there was that old Bob Michael decision at the D.C. Circuit where, you know, that even though the Senate and the House can establish their own rules under Article 1, Section 5, you can't really come up with new rules. I mean, the House cannot create new votes for new members of Congress that haven't been duly elected under a constitution. There's something wrong about imposing a 60-vote margin where the founders debated this, and there are multiple other places in the Constitution that require supermajority vote, but not for judicial confirmations. And, you know, to put 60 votes is now changing the balance that was carefully constructed. Now, maybe not a successful argument in the court system, but certainly a colorable argument to use on the Senate floor and come up with a way to change the rules. Otherwise, we're going to be sitting there, and folks had began to filibuster John Roberts' nomination, Miguel Estrada's nomination. And so I called up Senator Hatch at home. I said, Senator, I'm thinking about developing this. What do you think? And he said, you know, I will fight to my dying day to preserve the filibuster. It's what saved the country. I fought in 1978 for labor law reform, and don't go there. And I said, well, let me explain to you why I think. And so we had a little debate, and he was in Utah, and he goes, you know what? Why don't you write up a memo and send it to Bobby Bork? And if he likes it, let me know, and maybe we'll do that. Fortunately, we developed it. I did email him and George Will, and the debate went on. We didn't need it because the Gang of 14 was created, and Brett Kavanaugh, Priscilla Owen, Judge Roberts, and now Chief Justice Roberts and others were able to get confirmed Janice Rogers Brown, but it wasn't until 2013 where that actual process ended up being used by Senator Reid and others. But the respect that senators, particularly the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and others had of Judge Bork was what was fascinating to me, that they're willing to change the rules of the Senate and the constitutional structure if Judge Bork thought it was a good idea. So it's easy for some of us to look back on Judge Bork and his incredible career and speculate as to what might have been. But we do greater justice to his legacy by celebrating the profound influence and lasting mark he left on antitrust law. In that regard, today's conference commemorating the 40th anniversary of the antitrust paradox is particularly fitting. In recent weeks, I have reflected on Judge Bork's legacy and how we remember him today. In the legal academy and in the media, unfortunately, Judge Bork often is portrayed in polarizing terms, remembered mostly for his ill-fated nomination to the Supreme Court. That view overlooks the reality that Judge Bork's contributions to constitutional law and antitrust law have had enormous staying power. Indeed, I believe that these two fields have run on parallel tracks since Judge Bork made some of his greatest scholarly contributions in the 60s and 70s. Judge Bork helped bring a level of discipline and rigor to these two fields, both of which were sorely lacking in theoretical cohesion and neutral principles. His insights in antitrust and constitutional law have been accepted, embraced even, across the ideological spectrum, because they offer common analytical principles that are flexible to evolving circumstances. As a scholar of constitutional law, Judge Bork helped lead the movement to return the court's focus to the original meaning of the Constitution. Years before the Federalist Society was founded, Judge Bork recognized that constitutional law had lost its theoretical grounding. Characteristically, Judge Bork did not mince words about the state of affairs surrounding him. In his famous article, Neutral Principles and Some First Amendment Problems, he wrote, and I'll quote, "A persistently disturbing aspect of constitutional law is its lack of theory, a lack which is manifest not merely in the work of the courts, but in the public, professional, and even scholarly discussion of the topic. The result, of course, is that courts are without effective criteria, and therefore, we have come to expect the nature of the Constitution will change, often quite dramatically, as the personnel of the Supreme Court changes. In the present state of affairs, that expectation is inevitable, but it's nevertheless deplorable." Judge Bork went on to offer and defend the use of neutral principles in constitutional interpretation, which were consistent with the Madisonian structure of the Constitution. The rest, of course, is history, and its impact immense and long-lasting. Judge Bork helped light the spark of modern original thinking and scholarship. His principles gained prominence in courts, the academy, and in the public mind. Thanks to the work of Judge Bork, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and many others, they continue to be stimulated by the civil discourse through the Federalist Society programs like today and other ones that the Federalist Society organizes. At her confirmation hearing, Justice Kagan stated, quote, "We are all originalists. And at last year's Federalist Society National Lawyers Convention, Justice Gorsuch stated, quote, originalism has regained its place, textualism has triumphed, and neither is going anywhere." It's heartening to see that Judge Bork's neutral principles could bring these two formidable intellects together. A few scholars have noted that there are many parallels between Judge Bork's influence on constitutional law and antitrust law, and I believe these parallels deserve greater attention as we consider the past, present, and future of antitrust law. Then Professor Bork was finalizing the antitrust paradox at the same time that he published his famous 1971 article on neutral principles of constitutional law. The gap in their publication date is deceiving. Professor Bork completed the first draft of the antitrust paradox in 1969, but the turbulence of Yale Law School's campus around that time and other personal matters prevented him from finalizing it before he left to serve as Solicitor General in 1973. After completing his service in the executive branch, Professor Bork finally published his masterpiece in 1978, which is why we celebrate the 40th anniversary today. Otherwise, it might be the 50th. It's important to remember the context in which Judge Bork first wrote the antitrust paradox. As always, Judge Bork did not mince words. He wrote, quote, "Modern antitrust has so decayed that the policy is no longer intellectually respectable. For decades, courts had applied economically flawed analytical frameworks to antitrust law. Or as Judge Bork put it at the time, it was, quote, wrong to assume that the received opinion about antitrust was established theoretically and confirmed empirically by legislators and judges long ago. In fact, this established opinion rested on an intellectual base that did not exist." Judge Bork highlighted a number of economic errors and fallacies embedded in antitrust doctrine, including merger analysis, vertical price restraints, exclusive dealings, and predatory pricing. He demonstrated with devastating logic that many practices deemed inherently anti-competitive, in fact, had pro-competitive benefits that warranted consideration, not condemnation. American consumers continue to thank him today for his impact. The impact of these doctrinal errors was profound. As Judge Bork explained, antitrust rules at the time, quote, significantly impaired both competition and the ability of the economy to produce goods and services efficiently. The source of this harm, Judge Bork noted, rested in the lap of the judiciary. He explained that the Supreme Court, without compulsion by statute, and certainly without adequate explanation, has inhibited or destroyed a broad spectrum of useful business structures and practices. Though Judge Bork pulled no punches in his condemnation of faulty economic reasoning in antitrust opinions, his prescription was one of judicial modesty coupled with judicial engagement with economic evidence. He actually understood applied economics. Judge Bork explained first that, quote, the responsibility of the federal courts for the integrity and virtue of law requires that they take consumer welfare as the sole value that guides antitrust decisions. He expanded on this, writing, quote, that antitrust must employ economic reasoning follows, of course, from the identification of consumer welfare as the law's sole legitimate goal. Like Judge Bork's contributions to constitutional law, this consumer welfare framework has proven remarkably flexible and has attracted support across the ideological spectrum. Just as we are all originalists now, we can safely say we are all consumer welfare advocates now. The antitrust paradox has been cited in more than 50 district court rulings, including one last week, over 100 court of appeal rulings, and 18 Supreme Court opinions written by Justices Berger, Brennan, Powell, Blackmun, Stevens, Kennedy, Breyer, O'Connor, Thomas, and Scalia. Any day or moment, we may learn that the antitrust paradox appears in the Supreme Court's impending decision in American Express. Likewise, leaders of the Antitrust Division and the Federal Trade Commission have repeatedly reaffirmed the consumer welfare standard and noted that it guides their enforcement decisions. Despite this bipartisan consensus, as many of you know, Judge Bork's contributions to antitrust law has come under attack in the decades since the antitrust paradox was published, and even more so over the past couple of years. Some contend that the neutral principles of antitrust enforcement that he advocated fails to provide the tools to protect competition in the digital era. Still, others have invoked Judge Bork's criticism of per se rules barring certain practices in order to argue that the very same conduct should be per se legal. As these debates carry on, we ask, why has Judge Bork's antitrust framework achieved such resonance and staying power? I believe the answer lies in his embrace of economics and his receptiveness to innovation in economic methods of understanding competition. As Judge Bork wrote in a new epilogue to the antitrust paradox 15 years after it was originally published, quote, though the goal of the antitrust statutes as they now stand should be constant, the economic rules that implement that goal should not. It has been understood from the beginning that the rules will and should alter as economic understanding progresses, end quote. That insight forms the core of modern antitrust law. Enforcers and courts continue to rely on the latest economic tools in order to improve their understanding of what may or may not constitute harm to competition and ultimately to consumers. Judge Bork's embrace of evolving economics was not hollow. In his post-judicial life, I again had the honor of interacting with Judge Bork on the Microsoft case while I served as the counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Judge Bork firmly believed that Microsoft's business practices intended to preserve the company's monopoly position in violation of Section 2 of the Sherman Act. And he set forth his views in a famous opinion that he published in the New York Times 20 years ago. In that piece, he emphatically rejected, quote, the widespread impression that the Microsoft controversy should be resolved by an ideological litmus test. As he put it, the question is not one of politics or ideology, it is one of law and economics. That statement, I believe, best encapsulates Judge Bork's lasting contributions to antitrust law. It's a principle I embrace and live by today as we make consequential decisions at the Antitrust Division. You may recall that around the time of the Microsoft case, many had argued that antitrust had no role in the dynamic software industry, and that Microsoft could not possibly violate the antitrust laws as a matter of conservative ideology. The unanimous en banc decision would go on to hold key parts of that ruling against Microsoft's practices, as Judge Ginsburg, then Chief Judge Ginsburg, would probably recall well. Not long after the D.C. Circuit issued its decision in Microsoft, I was at a lunch with Judge Bork and others. One of the attendees claimed that the Court of Appeals got it totally wrong. They were trying to convince the chairman of the Judiciary Committee to go out and blast it and prevent the Justice Department from entering into a settlement with the Justice Department. Judge Bork, to his credit and integrity, strongly pushed back, arguing that it was correct under the antitrust laws and it was a well-written opinion, and there was no established principle to preclude the DOJ settlement. The Microsoft case was not only correctly decided, it was a testament to Judge Bork's approach to antitrust law. The consumer welfare standard remains the goal, while our economic tools and their applications to new business models and digital markets continue to evolve, we apply his principles. Thanks to the influence of Judge Bork's antitrust paradox, today we can proclaim that modern antitrust law is no longer, quote, a policy at war with itself. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We have time for questions. We've got a microphone near the front and one about two-thirds of the way back. If you have a question for Macon Delrahim, please queue up at the microphones. Right ahead.
Carl Zerbo with NetChoice. First of all, I really appreciated you going into the lion's den last week at OMI, where you concluded by quoting President Reagan, "I'm from the government, I'm here to help," as one of the concerns. As we go forward, how do you foresee your role in pursuing antitrust enforcement with that notion in mind of limited government while enabling economic development?
Well, I view the enforcement, I mean, my role is thankfully limited to the enforcement of the antitrust laws, and it is to really what the original goal of the antitrust laws were, to police the markets, to allow for economic liberty to continue, to allow for the incentives to innovate, to allow for that risk to take place by the entrepreneurs. I was in Italy a couple of weeks ago, and Mario Monti, the former commissioner of competition, was kind enough to invite me to talk to them about, you know, transatlantic dialogue and antitrust and consumer welfare standard. And we discussed, and there was a reporter who talked about, well, hasn't the center of gravity of antitrust moved over to Europe and to China and Korea? Because they're bringing more cases. They have brought X number of cases against Google, and they fined whatever it was in one of the Google search practices, you know, $1.5 billion and $2 billion for this, and they fined Qualcomm in Korea. And I said, you know, that's an interesting way to look at it. I don't measure the antitrust division's success by the fines, by the convictions we get, by the merger cases or litigation we bring. What I define U.S. antitrust law's success is the fact that we have these innovators. We have the Googles and the Facebooks and the Microsofts and the Ubers and Airbnbs coming out of the United States. How many of those innovative companies are coming out of Europe or Korea or China? So it was an interesting, and he pulled back a little bit and said, you know, that's a good point. I have no idea if he wrote about it. It's in Italian. I don't speak Italian or read it. But it was the first time I think they had kind of pushed back that antitrust law enforcement isn't. I mean, I'm hoping that the antitrust division goes out of business if people follow the law and there isn't the anti-competitive effect, because that's when consumers win. But our job is to go in there, police it, provide the guardrails, and move on.
Well, that's an interesting quote. Please queue up if you have a question. I'd want to ask a quick question from you, and that's while people get in line. How much do you take into account, or should the government take into account, its leadership role in antitrust law and the cues that foreign antitrust enforcers might take from the United States? I think it was a dozen years ago or so, 20 years ago, a half dozen countries had antitrust laws, and now 140 or so do. So maybe you could speak to that briefly.
It's a really important role, and largely because, not because we're the best, it's just that we've made more mistakes than many other new agencies have done. And so we have learned, you know, from the, whether it's the nine no-nos and with respect to intellectual property licensing, or a lot of the ills that Judge Bork wrote about in the antitrust paradox. And I think we have a very important role to provide that leadership, not in an ugly, heavy-handed way, but to help them explain why the proper principles are actually good. It's good for innovation and it's good for consumers. And that's what we've been doing. We have taken a number of initiatives, including this recently announced multilateral framework on antitrust procedures and investigations, which we're doing with our partners at the Federal Trade Commission and about a dozen or so international agencies, to come to some common understandings about some of the core values in the enforcement of antitrust law, to at least make sure that there's not, you know, xenophobic motivations behind some of the enforcement. And there's the proper role that we provide. We provide an incredible amount of technical assistance, sending our economists from the division, our lawyers, to go and train a lot of these younger and newer agencies, because it's an incredible power that if not exercised with a level of humility, can be really dangerous to the markets.
Very good. Why don't we go in the back and take a question? Just a couple minutes left, so try and be as concise as possible.
Good morning. Obviously, this conference is a little in the shadow of the ruling last week on Comcast and AT&T. And I was interested because the New York Times article, sort of the headline was basically saying, do we need to rethink Borkian analysis of antitrust in light of this ruling? So I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about how Borkian analysis for you affected your decision to look into this merger, especially because it was a vertical merger, and how you think going forward we should look at these vertical mergers in light of Bork.
Look, I think vertical mergers are largely pro-competitive. Major assets and aspects of them can be good, just as law and economics have taught us. But law and economics have also taught us that some aspects of it could be bad. And in fact, when they change the structure of a market, they could do more harm than a horizontal merger we get wrong, where the market could, over time, fix that. At least it's my view. But there's economic thinking. So I don't know if antitrust law needs to be rethought. I think it works perfectly well. It's flexible. I forget, was it Justice, was it Holmes who said, we're not final because we're infallible. We're infallible because we're final. And not every district court is final.
Well, final question here in the front.
Sure. Thank you for taking the question. This is the second time I've seen you speak this week. So I actually wanted to bring up a topic you brought up yesterday at AAI event, where you said that the DOJ is looking into not necessarily influencing, but informing lower district courts by way of amicus to, I guess, better understand the antitrust principles. And I was interested to see that the DOJ did speak on the Apple v. Pepper case. And from your perspective, what are the implications of that case and how do you see it going, if you could speak to it at all?
Well, we're gratified that the Supreme Court granted cert in that case. We'll on to the merits now. I think the Ninth Circuit got it wrong, and we'll see what happens, but I'll refer you to the brief that we and the Solicitor General filed in that case of where we thought they got it wrong. There's obviously a circuit split between the Ninth and the Eighth in the Ticketmaster case. And, you know, there's a whole issue of Illinois Brick and Hanover Shoe and all of that stuff. So we look forward to continued guidance from the Supreme Court on that case. And we have done that. You know, the amicus program has been incredibly successful so far, and it'll continue to be, and the judges have welcomed it. The judges who care about economics in antitrust law have welcomed that. And We filed along with the FTC in the Ninth Circuit case in Seattle, where Seattle tried to impose a new rule to unionize drivers of Uber. It was basically the first of its kind. It was a Boston one as well. But the Ninth Circuit got it right, and thankfully, and they largely took the arguments that the district court got wrong from the DOJ FTC brief. We filed an amicus down in Florida where the state bar is trying to prevent a technology company by allowing, you know, this app or calling this app an unauthorized practice of the law. We filed a statement of interest in a case, I want to say down in Virginia. There was a consummated merger where there were problems, and you know, we supported that. The court got it right, I think probably helped by some of the analysis we were able to provide. But some judges actually believe in some of the ways in the proper analysis of antitrust law, which is good.
Well, Macon, thank you so much for getting us off to a great start here today. We're going to continue without a break to our first panel. But before we do that, please join me in thanking Macon Delrahim.
Thank you so much. Thank you.